Okay, meeting will come to order. This is the Governmental Operations and Veterans Affairs interim meeting here on February 8th. Appreciate everybody coming in. I have a couple of announcements here before we start going through the items. Actually, we're waiting for one more member to have a quorum here for the meeting. If you want to pull your stuff out of your packet, we have several handouts today that we'll be going through, and we'll try to make reference to each of them as we get to that point of the agenda. We expect to go about 3 hours or so today, so we'll be done by lunch today. So people at the end will have the pressure of getting their materials done before lunch. A lot of the information we'll be going through today will be related to legislative reform, and several different bills we'll be talking about, continuing appropriations. And as you know, since it's an interim meeting, we won't be taking any official votes other than probably approval of the minutes today, which is an okay thing to do in the interim. Let's see, I wanted to highlight our meeting next week is on Thursday, February 16th. And we expect that one to go from 9 until noon or maybe 12:30 that day. And that will be focusing on the Veterans Affairs part of our committee. And we don't expect to have any other committee meetings at this point until the legislature goes back in session on March 1st. And so watch for the schedule. We have kind of a shortened schedule those first 2 weeks because of precinct caucuses. But we only have, it's less than 10 meetings between when we initially start and our first deadline at the end of March. So things will probably be moving fairly quickly. And we'll probably be talking to you about adding some evening meetings in maybe that third week in March. So keep that in mind, and we'll get you some information as soon as possible. And actually, it would be helpful if during the meeting or after the meeting today, if there's certain nights that you know that you can't make it, please let our committee legislative assistant, Alicia Davis, know about that. But we'll probably be scheduling some additional meetings. As you know, with GovOps, oftentimes we are the second or third or fourth committee that a bill goes to, and so we don't really know oftentimes if it's coming or not until the very end. But we want to move those bills through to first deadline and second deadline as quickly as we can, obviously. So with that, we do have a quorum now. Appreciate that, members. And Representative Liebling, approval of the minutes.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move approval of the minutes of November 8th, 2005.
Representative Liebling moves approval of the minutes of the November 8th meeting. Any discussion? All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted, approved. Okay. Members, we have a new member of our committee. We've lost Representative Mahoney, who's been on our committee. He's transferred to other committees because of the special election with Representative Opatz. And so we have a wonderful new replacement in our newest member. And I'm going to have trouble with your last name. I'm going to ask you how you pronounce it differently than the other Representative Larry Howes. So with that, I'd like to introduce Larry. Is it
Haas?
Haas. Okay, I'm going to have a little trouble with that, but please introduce yourself.
Thank you very much, and I'll get rid of the life is but a bowl full of Larry's. We'll get that right out of the way before I start. And I understand that you would like to know a little bit about me. I started my career after I graduated from Mankato State. I was the coach and teacher of the baby boomers. So you'd say, why do all those seniors know you? It's like, I'm older than they are. You know? And there was a lot of them. I went from teaching to being a park, somewhere in park and recreation, but I spent 32 years with the park and recreation department. So I was entwined with their families and the families of my community for many, many years and watched a lot of generations grow up. I started a senior center program when I was 27 years old, and I stayed with it till I was eligible to participate. I was, if that's a thought, it was conflict of interest probably, right? I was a three-year, I was three times elected to a Stearns County Commissioner. And one of the interesting connections as a Stearns County Commissioner is that we have Veterans Service Program. And so in that process, we also hired the Veterans Service Officer. I thought it was once logical to put Veterans Service in the Human Service Department. And I got to meet an awful lot of veterans after I made that statement. That they all lined up with many medals on, and I gave up at about the second or third testifier in. I said, I'm sorry I made that comment. I also had an opportunity to participate in front of and after your proposal for the money for the new dormitory, the Al Lair Studio, that's going to be built at the Veterans Administrative Hospital. And the Veterans Administrative Hospital is a major portion of the St. Cloud community and has been for since 1940. So I'm excited about being on this committee, and I'm very honored to serve. And Dan Severson and I are friends, and we are close enough friends to argue where we disagree. And thank you for allowing me to introduce myself.
Great, well, welcome. Okay, let's move on the agenda here. We're at item number four, legislative reform, House survey results, and Representative Loeffler and I are going to go to the testifying table, but before I do, I just wanted to highlight the items in your packet that we'll be referencing. So hopefully they're kind of in order. Legislative reform, it's a two-page front and back. And then there's one called the House 2006 Legislative Reform Initiative, top-ranked suggestions by theme. And then a packet with bar charts that is the House Member Survey of Legislative Reform Priorities. So if you can pull those out, members, we'll be going through those for the next half hour, 45 minutes, and have kind of an open discussion about legislative reform, and that will lead into several bills that we'll be talking about afterwards on continuing appropriations, and those are in your packet, as well as, members, your blue form, too, so anytime during the morning if you can get that filled out and taken care of, that would be appreciated. So with that, I'd like to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Severson.
Welcome to your committee, and if you wouldn't mind, please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Representative Diane Loeffler, and I'm delighted to be here with Kathy Tinglestad to share a project that all of you had a chance to participate in. And just to set the stage for our newest member, Larry Hall, who was not part of the effort, we're all going to trip on the last name for a little bit, Larry,
right.
Forgive us. And last spring and summer, we found ourselves in the situation of an extended special session. And there was a lot of frustration in the public, but there was also a lot of frustration with those of us who serve in how we got there. And there was a lot of gathering of people in small groups and large groups about and talking about how did we get here, how can we avoid this in the future. And a lot of creative thinking was going on about how to avoid the situation we found ourselves in. How can we do our work more efficiently and have it result in timely, thoughtful decisions that avoid special sessions? And I thought we ought to start collecting those ideas. And one of the people I was talking to was Representative Kathy Tinglestad, who thought that was a great idea as well. And together we initiated a system of requesting from both House staff, who have a lot of insight, as well as House members, their ideas for how we might look at doing our business different to do it more timely and more efficient. And we asked people to submit their ideas. And so we weren't going to deal with them. We weren't going until later on when things had calmed. But we wanted to capture those ideas. And 48 ideas were submitted. Kathy and I worked over the fall and put them together into a survey that was sent out to all House members in which people could rank the results as definitely consider, worth consideration, don't consider, or unsure, or don't understand. And we had 67 members, almost half of our membership, participate in that survey. It was almost equally divided between the parties, and we're sharing with you today the results. And so that's sort of how we've gotten to this point. We're not naive. We know that process and policy can be trumped by personality and power, but we do know that the structure and the rules by which we do our business does make a difference, and so we're going to be launching today a discussion of those ideas that our peers have said are worthy. And with that, Kathy's going to talk a little bit about sort of what the next steps are.
Thank you, Representative. Well, it's interesting watching the committee this morning as we were coming in during our interim meeting today. As you know, last year we had a seating chart, and it was kind of set up because we had two Petersons and several different names that sounded the same. And so today we set the folders on the side here, just kind of allowing you to choose where you'd like to go, which side of the table. And I see that Representative Seifert, Dempsey, and Kahn kind of went with the mix there and went with their colleagues from the other side of the aisle. I know that was one of the items that was suggested, is that in committee meetings there be a mix of Republicans and Democrats sitting next to each other. So I was interested to see your own personal selection this morning, so you might want to keep that in mind for future things. But I really appreciate working with Representative Loeffler, I think we'd like to just start highlighting some of the things that we've seen on the results here. And we hope to take this information through the legislative session this year. A lot of it relates to how do we avoid government shutdown, how do we make our process more friendly to citizens, work the bills through the system in a more orderly manner. And so a lot of the things relate to kind of administrative things that we do here, or things related to some possible legislative rule change, and some are things that we'll deal with bill introductions. But you'll see on the handouts that the information is sort of tabulated in a couple different ways. And the first one I'd like to highlight is just the one that says the legislative reform, and it's a front and back. And it's a kind of a very simple way of looking at the numbers. And Representative Loeffler will go through kind of a topic area, which I think starts to group them into areas where we can take the next step from there. So as you see with the analysis of results there, we have things grouped up. A1 through A16, and those were the items that were all considered. The highest ranking was for definitely consider. And you can see that the top item there was stagger the elections for Senate seats so that half the Senate seats are elected every 2 years, and that was 58%. Well, you can tell that this was the House survey, because I don't know that the Senate would necessarily say that, but we'll be talking to them about that. And as members recall, we did pass that bill through our committee here last year, and it went to the House floor and was awaiting action, so it still could be acted on this year. Number A2 there, with automatic appropriations to prevent government shutdown, you can see there was a lot of support for that, where agencies would temporarily continue funding at their prior levels until a new budget is set. And we'll have four different bills that we'll be looking at today that will help to address that. I don't know if we want to go through item by item, but maybe Representative Loeffler, if you could jump in here and any other explanation before we get into a discussion.
Sure. Well, just to basically explain how your different handouts are different, you can tell I'm a planning analyst in my other life. So I look at that in a lot of different ways, and think other people find it interesting that way as
Representative
well.
Representative Loeffler, could you just hold for just 1 second to think Representative Peterson has a question?
On your percentages, 57%, 55%, that is of those who voted, or of the 134?
Of those who voted.
Of those who voted. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler, please continue.
So just to let you know, what you have here is on the bar chart, what you have is the complete results for the top 28. These are what the suggestions that received over 60% support for consideration. and you'll see that we have barcoded, so you can see that the level of support. For example, the first item there has a total of 92% of the respondents thought we should consider it, 43% said definitely consider, 49% said worth consideration, only 6% said don't consider, and 2% weren't sure. And so that says that for joint House and budget targets before the third deadline, there's a lot of commonality across parties amongst the 67 people who participate in the ranking. And you can, and as you go through, you'll see some other ones that have a lot more tension. There might be really strong consideration, definitely consider, but there's also very strong don't consider. And so that says when we take those up, we can expect a lot more debate. And it won't be as easily worked out, perhaps, in terms of the details. The third handout that you have, which says top-ranked suggestions by theme, was my attempt to take the top 28, which were the ones that had over two-thirds of the people who participated saying, we should look at this, and group them, because I think it's hard to look at a long, long list and not have it sorted out some way. And so this was my attempt to try and sort it into sort of the general themes. For the public, I tend to say it's basically improve Senate and House interaction, make better use of the early months of the session, and put more discipline into the budget process. But for us to make decisions, we really need to look at a lower level of detail. And you'll see that the first grouping is reducing House-Senate differences and increasing Senate-House interaction. And we might want to consider looking at a variety of these ideas together and putting them together in a package for those that people feel are worthy of a hearing and further discussion. The second major group, and it was actually our largest group, and I think it was because we were in the, when these ideas came forward, we were in the midst of debating budget issues, were all about the budget time frame and how do we do our work. And a common theme in these is that people really would like to see us making more of our significant decisions earlier in the session and to allow us to have more time at the end then for resolving differences with each other and with the Senate and the governor. And these are ranked according to, you know, sort of their popularity. So as we go down, there's less and less support for each of these themes, but it's certainly still strong. The third grouping was to balance the participation in decision-making. There were a variety of suggestions related to how power and authority is shared between the administration and the legislature, for example, the one dealing with fiscal notes, as well as how we use each of members' talents and ideas within our committee process. The fourth was to brief everyone on the issues. And you'll see very high rankings on this. It's clear that, and I think we saw this last year at the end of the session when we saw the ad hoc groups emerging, that people felt like they'd all wanted to know what were these key issues and get a good background on it. And there were a variety of suggestions saying early in the session we should have nonpartisan briefings on sort of the basic facts and figures and policy context for some of the issues that are going to divide us that year. And then the last one is a couple of recommendations about specifics related to our rules and how we consider specific bills. So this was just one attempt to try and sort of group these things so that you might sort of see how different ideas might relate to each other. The C rank that you'll see after each of these is that consideration rank. It's the combined total of the percentage who said don't definitely consider and worth consideration. So it's just a way for you to kind of gauge the popularity of these while you look at them grouped by item. And with that, I think we can start the discussion or answer questions.
Mr. Chair, members, just to be clear then, the information that's on these two sheets is pretty much identical, 26, 28 items that were top ranked out of the 48 or so questions that were on the survey. The other ones were the don't consider low on the ranking, so we thought we'd concentrate on the highest ones. As you can see, results are numbered, and so we thought through our discussion today, if you would look at how the definitely considered are all considered like A1 through 16. So if you're referencing, for example, A8, that's the joint House and Senate target budget target set before the third deadline, and on the other form, we have everything numbered 1 through 5 with the numbers underneath. So, for example, 1E would be stagger the elections for Senate seats, half the Senate seats every 2 years. And so on this sheet, it has some combined numbers of the definitely consider and worth consideration, and the other sheet is kind of more raw information, just based on those two categories of definitely consider and worth consideration. But together, both sheets have the same items on them. It's just a matter of how they were ranked or how they're grouped. So I don't know if that's clear, if anybody has questions on that before we get started.
Thank you, Representative Tingelstad and Representative Loeffler. Questions from the committee? Seeing none, Representative Dempsey.
Thank you. The question I have is that it's good that we've got this information, and I appreciate the work that you've done in regard to that. I guess my point would be is, what's the next step? Mm-hmm. And I think I don't know the degree that you're going to talk about. What kind of changes do you think are needed? How might they be? Should they be in legislation, or should they be through an amendment to the Constitution of the state of Minnesota, or whatever the case may be? Because there are some things that you can propose that are, and I'm one of those, that'll solve the problem better. Because there are some things that we do with the Senate and I'll give you an example, and it has to do with committees. The House passes a bill. It goes over to the Senate. Okay? And we see that you get into the conference committee and you can change the whole thing. Well, why do we do that then? Now, there's those that are going to say, we can do that. I'm just saying that what I'm trying to do is to take a look at how do you solve the problem. Obviously, we've got a problem at the present system. Now, you can do things on the fringes, mm-hmm. or you can go to the bottom line and say, this is what we should do. And that's why I'm just concerned a little bit as to what basically might you want to do. For example, just let me give you an example of what I mean by solving the problem. And there are two of them. One has to do with the pieces of legislation that Representative Kahn and myself and other people. We see things. Why do you close down government? It's goofy. Well, we do a lot of goofy stuff because we don't have solutions to the problem. Let me give you another example. And this has to do because of my background in education. But that is we have in the public school system where we throw kids out of school. It's called out of school suspension. Now, that's the best we can do in the system, and I'm not on the committee and so on, but I'm one of the few in the legislature, to be honest with you, that's been in the classroom and in school administration. Okay? There aren't many of those kinds of people in this whole body that does a tremendous job in regard to the job is tremendous, to how do we fund and how do we do all the things in the public school system. And I got a solution to the problem of having out-of-school suspension for kids. It's like going to the doctor, and the doctor says, well, get out of here until you're well. How does that solve any problem? And so we've got those kinds of situations that they don't come up simply because your background isn't in that area. And I'm not faulting anybody, but it's the same way with the information. Now, you can go out here and say, well, Jeff, we don't want to take a look at that, and we tried that, and I've been here this long. We don't need that political stuff. We need to get down to the problem and solve the problem, not just keep funding a program that doesn't work. This one didn't, before my time, But I can remember when the state of Minnesota, and I think maybe I'm taking too much time, because I'm off leading a little bit. But
did you have a question, Representative Johnson?
Yes, I did, and I'm trying to...
I did,
and I just wanted to cover the bases so that I wouldn't be counteracted in regards to it. But anyway, so much for that. I'd like to see where you go in regard to that. But just as a case in point, there was to give you an example of sometimes we don't do things that are too swift. And one of those was, as I can remember, I was in school administration when the state of Minnesota lowered the drinking age from 21 to 18. Boy, that was not wisdom in action. And then the oops mentality takes place. Oops, well, we goofed that up. I guess we got to read it back. We're 21. Well, that was just a political issue. That's all it was. Now, I'm sure people will say, oh, well, you don't know. You weren't here, Dempsey. You don't know what you're talking about. No. But all I'm saying is that it didn't solve a problem. It created one. And so the same thing in regard to the programs, I think it's a good idea. I really do. And I think that the next step is the important one, is to take this information and what are going to be some of those that are going to be decided. Now, I don't know how the chair is going to do in regard to that, but certainly there are processes that you can do that you could propose as to some of these solutions that are going to solve problems. And one of the big problems that we have is in conference committees, as I mentioned to you. That's a problem. You pass something in the House and it doesn't mean anything. So you go to the conference committee and they're going to do what they want to do. And so on. So I just wanted to share that with you. And Mr. Chairman, I will end my remarks.
Well, thank you for your remarks, Representative Dempsey. You've been an esteemed member of the House for a considerable amount of time. And for those who don't know, he's Representative Dempsey, this is his last year, and he will be missed here in the House. Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was going to make a comment on this, but I can't resist responding to Representative Dempsey as the only person on this committee who is here and voted to lower the voting age, and voted against raising it, and probably the only person in this group who grew up in a state with an 18-year-old drinking age, and as someone who's always prided myself on having probably the wettest voting record combined with the driest lifestyle of any legislator in the area, I will just say that the problems of age 21 are shown. If you read today's paper, you'll see the increased amount of binge drinking, the increased amount of illegal drinking, and this whole sense of forbidden fruit. And the major argument since I was here at the time, if you remember, this was during the Vietnam War, and the argument was if you were able to go fight and die for your country, you ought to be able to get a drink in a bar. So, you know, I defend both of those votes that I cast. Now, the next...
I knew there was a Veterans Affairs related issue to that whole topic.
Quite appropriate for this.
Now, what I was going to say before I was interrupted by that thought was that there are two items on here, both of which I support, and both of which could be facilitated by one that isn't on here. And the two items using the bar code are number 2 and number 5. And the most simple thing we could do to facilitate both of those would be to set the House and Senate chambers at the same time. And we'll remember that the reason that they were originally... Now, I wasn't here at the turn of the century or when they were originally set at different times. But the reason they were originally set at different times was because the only committee rooms were in the Capitol, and so you had to free up committee rooms for one while the other one was in session. Now, of course, that may be another problem with the redoing of the Capitol, but the point is there's no need for them to be different. There's very little coverage, and in fact, we understand that when most of the exciting stuff is going on in the legislature, most of the stuff that people pay attention to, they are meeting at the same time, i.e. all the time. So if you started to do that, and that also fits in with the idea for more House and Senate interaction, I kind of have tried to several times done power walking planning trips with Senators Pappas and Anderson through the tunnels, and it's amazing how difficult it is to find a time to do it when the Senate is convening at noon and when the House is convening at 3 and so forth. So if we had specific times, you know, like lunch was always a clear time, which we've tried to do that in the House, you know, that would allow for much more non-committee interaction between members. And if we just started by scheduling the sessions at the same time, then that would free us to look at parallel committee structures and structuring the committees at the same time. And again, once the committee's schedules are set at the same time, then as far, I remembered when I chaired GovOp and when Jim Metzen chaired GovOp, and we were bringing in an outside speaker to talk on rules, and it was just almost impossible to find a time when it was free for everyone to hear. Whereas the obvious thing, if both committees met at the same time, the committee time would have been a perfect time to do it. So I'd like to put that on the table as a current, you know, saying I strongly support those two. And that's the first step that could be made to do that.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to address both Representative Dempsey's and Representative Kahn's comments. I appreciate that. First of all, I just want to highlight on the legislative reform handout on the back, it does mention next steps, and so what we're looking at here, what will happen. You know, today I feel like Representative Loeffler and I are kind of the messengers of the survey results, and, you know, as you know, since we're both members of GovOps and also rules, you know, personally we'll be doing things with our own legislation that will relate to that, but I encourage each of you to take hold of this. And you know, Representative Dempsey, I really appreciate your passion for solving the problem, and I hope that all 134 members of the House and 67 members of the Senate will also have that passion for solving the problem here at the Capitol. And I think, you know, we need to work within our structure, and obviously by teaming up with groups of people who have similar interests, we can take on those various issues. And as you know, there's an upcoming conference with legislators where we'll actually be taking the next steps with this information, as well as some information put together by the Center for the American Experiment. So, and definitely Representative Kahn, with the parallel committee structure, that would happen after this next election as things get organized in December and January for the upcoming legislative session next year. And since, you know, the senators only are elected once every 4 years, that committee restructuring could not happen again until 4 years later. So we have an ideal time to address especially that issue right now. I'll turn it over to Representative Loeffler, see what comments she has on those particular items, and then we'll take other questions.
Representative Loeffler, before you start, we have a question from Representative Newgay. Representative Hawes.
Oh, it was answered over here by Representative.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Representative Loeffler,
Mr. Chairman. Well, I think that it'll be interesting to see how this evolves, but I'm optimistic by the fact that there were so many people who participated and that the consensus on many of these items, including the ones that Representative Kahn just overviewed, was bipartisan. I mean, and it was into, and that's why I like looking at the bar charts a little bit, just because you could see how there wasn't a lot of polarization on most of these issues, and I think that bodes well. And I think it'll be interesting as we continue and begin discussions with the Senate to see if we have that same sort of broad interest in looking at new ways of doing things. The idea that Phyllis had also mentioned of having the House and Senate meet in chamber at the same time was actually one of the ideas that was suggested. It didn't quite make that top 28, but I have the full results here. We did send those to members, and 53% of the people felt that we should consider that, but there were about 34% who felt that we shouldn't consider it. So it's once again one of those issues whether there's difference of opinion and that would need to be worked out before it would move forward, as opposed to some of them which seem to have a very strong consensus with very few negatives. And it's been intriguing to me as a first-termer to see how many joint committee meetings there have been during the interim on sharing information, hearing from various business groups, those sorts of things. And I think that it'll be interesting to see for people who participated in those joint hearings how their enthusiasm for bringing those into the regular session as one of the suggestions here is that we've been discussing.
And Mr. Chair, just to add on to that, too, One of the things we're looking at for the GovOps committee here is perhaps doing a package of legislative reform issues that would have no fiscal impact. So that would be something that we could gather through various bills that we'll hear in our committee here. So I especially encourage any of you who have ideas or are particularly interested in working on one of these items to take hold of it, and we'll give you a hearing here in March and move it along with our package through the legislature.
Thank you, Representative Timothet. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Madam Chair. My question is, do you anticipate putting together a comprehensive bill that would be a legislative reform bill and moving that out of Government Operations Committee after we've heard a number of the bills, or do you see moving separate bills as more effective? Just what is your game plan if we do bring forward some of the bills that are at the top of the list?
Mm-hmm. Representative Tickleson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Welty. Yeah, my initial thoughts are let's do an omnibus legislative reform package, and certainly open to other ideas, and, you know, especially interested in any input, you know, ideas that you have as far as how that would work. Obviously, we'd want to do it so that would have the best advantage of, you know, passing the legislature. So I'm open to that.
Thank you, Representative Tingle. One question I had was, out of the number of surveys that you put out, how many responses did you have, and was the Senate contacted or offered or included into the survey?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members, this was a House-only survey because the ideas were only solicited from the House. We started this in the last week of the special session, and so there wasn't a lot of time and to coordinate even amongst ourselves, let alone reach across to the Senate and figure out who would be our best Senate partners in initiating it there. Although the senators are very interested in it and have asked for copies of it, we'll be discussing it with us jointly at the seminar that Representative Kingelstead had mentioned, and so I think there's a fair interest there. In the House, we had 67 of the 134 members complete the ratings, and it took about 10 to 15 minutes, depending upon how seriously you pondered each option before you decided which box to check on the computer survey. And since it was happening in late December, early January, that was a time when many people were obviously consumed with family and other demands. But to have almost half of the participants, I think it's a fairly representative result, particularly when we looked at the partisanship, and it was pretty almost equally balanced, just as we are in the body. So it isn't tilted towards we only had, you know, Republicans responding or only Democrats. It reflects pretty basically our makeup in the legislature.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Hush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Tingelstad and Loeffler. Just one question that I have. I know you said it was pretty equally divided between Republicans and Democrats. I think it'd be interesting to know how that division was when voting on some of these issues, and if there was any kind of propensity for it to maintain certain power structures among the parties, because I think you could have that, and I think that would be evident also in the other body too, and that's concerning, because to look at the legitimacy of trying to get some of these reform ideas through, we have to kind of know the landscape of things. I mean, one example would be to let each caucus appoint their members to committees. Mm-hmm. I would have a feeling that there would probably be quite a division among our parties. And as unfortunate as it is, it's a reality. So is that something that would be difficult to put together?
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hosh, as members are aware, and for the public to understand, we used an electronic survey tool in which people were sent emails and then could click on the responses, and we had it electronically assembled. We set it up with two email lists. I sent to the Democratic members of the House, Kathy Tingelstad's email account sent out to the Republican members, and that allowed us to keep track of the partisanship in terms of the overall participation, but we did not separately keep track of the results by individual or by party, and I think it's more appropriate for us to present them as a total, but we did keep track of the partisanship just because we did want to be able to say whether or not we felt this was a reflective result in terms of participation. So at this point, the electronic survey poll has totaled them all together, and we don't have plans to pull that out by party.
Follow up, Representative Hush?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Hush. as far as your point about the appointment of members to committees, you know, I think that's something that could definitely be dealt with. And actually, I don't know if everybody knows how people are appointed to committees, but my experience has been that of the 25 or so committees that we have here, each member picks out four, five, six committees they're interested in, and typically they're tried. Each member tries to get to, you know, one or two of those committees of their top choices. But so much of who's on which committee depends on the balance of geography, men and women, several different issues, and then trying to make sure that people with the most background in certain topic areas get in those committees, which doesn't always happen. And I know that at least half of the House members always request the Education Committee, and, you know, there's just very few spots available there. But I think in working with leadership and some of our executive staff, I think the next time around, you know, in December, January upcoming, that we could definitely, you know, work with that some more. And that would be a matter of not any kind of legislation or rule change. That's just a matter of a few members getting together and saying we're going to do this and sitting down with the appropriate people at the appropriate time and moving that through. So, you know, it's not any simple answers, but I think a lot of it can be addressed.
Thank you, Representative Tengelstad. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the two for putting this together and the members for attending today. I'm of the opinion that the government shutdown was premeditated by leadership and occurred on purpose because it's a way for, and I'm setting my watch to about October 10th when the campaign ad will come out that says, I'm ineffective, I'm a shutdown legislator, and, you know, there were already buttons saying governor shutdown, and we want to work, and put us back to work, keep the state park open, grandstanding on the floor about the gates of the park kept to be open, hurry up and get the park open, people are waiting. And I think, you know, there's obviously a campaigns and election industry that, you know, these political operatives and seasonals that move across the whole country come into places and they figure out a way to make you look bad. And if I think you're naive if you think you're going to weather the storm this November without being called ineffective and a shutdown legislator. I just think that's going to occur. And I'm wondering if there could have been a question on here. Do you think the government shutdown was premeditated on leadership's part? And talking with Representative Seifert a little bit, you know, if this column in this histogram includes, you know, the leadership, then, you know, we're all saying this, but if leadership's down here, I think the cumulative effect of your survey is hopefully going to take hold. I just wonder how much of it's tangible and will be implemented if leadership doesn't care. And really I'm talking about the soft money, independent expenditures that both parties use at the end of the campaign, the last 5 weeks, when gloves are off, and I'm going to be a shutdown person on the radio. I just know it.
Any response? Representative Tengelstad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson. It's a hard one to respond to because I'm sure we'll all get those campaign pieces. You know, it's important that we as legislators try to set the tone, and obviously we can't be in control of all the outside, you know, groups that, you know, participate or have an interest in, you know, the results of the election. But I think by us sort of grabbing hold of this whole situation and trying to put as much of a positive spin and especially in being empowered to make some changes that are going to result in some good differences. You know, I remember once seeing information about the amount of lobbying money spent in Minnesota, and I think it was something like 8 lobbyists for each legislator, if you look at, you know, the typical amount of salary that everybody makes. And so, you know, even though we can influence others, you know, if you've got 8 other people out there trying to influence you at the same time, you know, there's obviously some inequities that occur. But we're just saying, you know, this is our place. Let's do the best we can.
Right, and just follow. I hope that you're starting the, like they said, the cumulative effect of this is gets up into leadership and they pay attention. Because it seemed like when the rump group got to about 60, 70, 80, 90, then things started to move. But I thought maybe that could have occurred in, you know, the end of May, not the end of June.
Representation, I said that I didn't, you know, we're not naive in thinking that doing these kind of changes will change, you know, prevent all possibilities of difficulty or gridlock or major problems, because we know that politics and power and personality play a huge role. And it could be either party that could elect a governor, or the people could elect a governor who just loves to veto things, and that in itself could shut things down no matter what your process is.
Sure.
But I also think that the structure by which we do our work influences the opportunities to avoid that. And if we were able to move up our processes, as many of these suggestions suggest, we would hit a point of that serious negotiation and compromise perhaps earlier. Some of the recommendations are to deal with significant controversial issues early in the session and clear them off the decks. And, you know, that might reduce the tension levels with which we're dealing with the remaining levels. And so I'm still optimistic that even though this won't solve all problems, some of these changes going forward have the impact, potentially, of giving us more opportunities to have a peaceful, thoughtful, timely end to the session. The other thing is, I just think in every crisis there's opportunities, and that's where change comes from. And many of these ideas, members have told me, are ones they've been thinking about for years. And it's hard to get people interested in just process changes, deadline changes, rule changes in the normal course of the busyness of considering policy issues. And because we kind of hit a dramatic end at the end of last year, we now have sort of the attention of the public as well as the members on saying, whoa, maybe it's time to look at how we do our business, and let's bring all those ideas that have been simmering for a while forward and start looking at which one should we do right now. Tradition is important, but maybe it's time now to look at whether some of our traditions need changing. So it won't solve everything. I totally agree with you, but I think it's still worth investing in.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me say something about the shutdown. This was a comment that was made at a neighborhood meeting by my senator, who many people say is part of the problem, Senator Pogonilla. And he was actually responding to a constituent who was screaming about, you're all bickering, you're all fighting, you know, you can't get along, that's why government shut down and that kind of thing. And Larry actually made a very thoughtful comment. He said, it wasn't really small issues. It was very big issues. I and some other people very fundamentally believe that local government aid should not be decreased. And the governor very firmly, I'm not going to talk about legislative people who agreed with him, but the governor very firmly believed that state taxes had to be controlled and that local government aid should be decreased, and it was only the fault of the local units of government. And that's not a little bickering thing. That was a big philosophical conflict. Then on the health care issue, you know, specifically Linda Berglund, who at some one point was blamed for shutting down the legislature all by herself, firmly believed that 20,000 people, of whom 16,000 of them were children, should not be dropped off Minnesota Care. And in order to resolve that budget issue, there was, and again, the people on the other side very firmly believed that controlling taxes was more important. But he said, whichever side you're on, those are not piddly little issues. Those are big, serious, fundamental issues, and it is appropriate to have, you know, it's, and Representative Dempsey and I and others have bills in to make sure that, to try and say that we don't shut down because of the costs of shutdown way above the accounted costs of shutdown. But the point is, you know, I think we have a right to make, you know, maybe one of the first things that Larry said that I just uniformly agreed with him. I thought it was a very thoughtful comment, and it was a really true comment about shutdown. And so what we want to do is we'd like to resolve those things earlier. But to kind of pretend that it was just silly bickering and that it was just, isn't really true, at least in this case. And let me say something, the other comment that I'd like to respond to is that the power of the lower level members. We don't know who's going to be control, in control next session, and I'm looking around the room. I'm not sure I see anybody who's going to be in the leadership, the top leadership, whether we're in control or not. But, you know, the basis of members has to be asserted very, very early. And we all know that caucus leadership tries to take, and either caucus tries to take a very tight control. And the point is, I think, to try and start that. Another thing which didn't get on this, you alluded to it about choosing seats in committee. But, again, when I was, you know, I hate to always sound like the person who starts after saying, you know, I walked 5 miles through the snow uphill both ways to school when I was a kid, and you have it all easy. But, again, when I was first elected, we chose seats on the House floor strictly based on seniority. And we all, and they were all, you know, they tended to have the Democrats on the same side that they are now and the Republicans on the other side. But there were all kinds of islands and pockets. And particularly there was kind of a peninsula that stuck out into the Democratic growth. I remember, I was just talking about this with Tony Bennett, who was one of them. Tony Bennett, Bob Pavlak, and Robert Bell, who was an ordinary, into the, and this poor guy, Bob Bell, he sat there, and in front of him was Joan Groh, next to him was Linda Berglund, and in back of him was me. And he took care of us through the entire session. He told us what motions to make, he drafted our amendments, he told us when to say something and when to not say something. I mean, it was just at one point I remember him holding his head in his hand and saying it was something that Linda had that had just gone down, complaining about what awful things he had voted for this year because we were all so earnest and we were so intent on getting things done. And he couldn't believe he had just voted for whatever this thing was that Linda was trying to do. But that kind of thing, you know, that you had people talking to each other and you had people and, you know, choosing, not having these strict lines would make an awful lot of sense. So there are things that we can start to do even before, if we have a set of people in both caucuses who are intent in changing what the structure is. You know, there are things we can start doing right away from the time of the election, or assuming, again, that all of us will be, all of us who are maybe won't have as tough elections ourselves will be campaigning for people that will have tough elections, and some of them, obviously, on each side will get elected. I mean, you start talking to those people whose campaigns you're working in and start talking to them about the importance of having, you know, the lower level members having more of a say and the importance of changing the attitude of the House.
By my follow-up.
Representative Peterson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Representative Kahn, for your historic perspective. I mean, I didn't ever say that the subject matter was lightweight at the end.
Yeah.
And it's clearly very deeply held and philosophical. You know, this is what I think, this is what I don't think. But the way to get your agenda into the majority or to run the show is to win enough seats to run the body. So I still think there was the premeditation on, all right, it's very closely divided, 68 to 66. It's very close in the Senate. If you add it all up with an independent here or there and a Republican governor, it's almost tied. And how are we going to fight this out? Well, there'll be a shutdown, and we're going to have a big old battle in November of 2006 to see who is most effective at tainting those with being ineffective as shutdown legislators. I just think it's just another, it's a way, it's a campaign. It's a campaign tool. That's why I see it as. And I hope that, you know, there's tangible things that come out of this that decrease that technique as to smearing somebody at the end of their campaign when, you know, they're just one of 134 and they'd rather not have a shutdown. Just a comment.
Good discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tinkstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson, I appreciate those comments. And, you know, I just really encourage everybody to take hold of some of these problem-solving areas here and see what we can get implemented over the next few months and over the next year. I know our national organization, the National Council on State Legislatures, NCSL, they're trying to do a project around the country where information about how the legislature works is promoted in a more positive manner. And I think, you know, somehow through the years, you know, we kind of get into a situation like used car salesman or something where, you know, we're the brunt of the jokes and this and that. And I think, you know, when each of us start helping our industry, our position here in sort of elevating the importance and the honor of being here, I think that kind of helps set the tone for a lot of different things to happen. So I'm hopeful that there's a new era here at the legislature, and we take the pain that we all experienced last summer with the shutdown and other issues and use that energy to really do some positive things here at the Capitol that will result in some good things for the future.
Representative Loffler, do you have any?
I just want to, in closing, say thank you to all the members of the House and of our staff who submitted ideas, and especially to those who took the time to fill out the ratings and participate in that process. And I hope that those who really want to be a part of this will engage with us as we consider these issues further as the committee evolves. And with that, I just say thank you for the time and for the energy and the thoughtful consideration.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to emphasize really how appreciative we are of all the work that you did, because I know you really have been, both of you, put in quite a considerable amount of work on this, and we can see that by the product, it's a great product. And I also really appreciate what Representative Tingelstad said, or what I thought I understood you to say, which is that even though we don't have it in our power to do everything, that we should not stop doing anything to try to change the tone. We have to continue, move forward to do whatever we can do. You know, if we can't do anything, then nobody can. So I really appreciate this, and I hope that at the very least it'll kind of set us on a tone and get us talking with each other and listening to each other, most importantly, about how we can change things. So thank you.
I appreciate that. Well, and members, you know, I thought the timing of the hearing was good today in getting some of this information and then giving you a couple weeks to kind of pull some things together. As you know, we have one early bill introduction next week, but then on March 1st, if it's possible for any of you to get any bills in the hopper that might relate to this, and certainly there's other areas where you can do rule changes or administrative changes. But you know, I really encourage you to take hold of any of these issues and get a bill introduced. And, you know, I will guarantee we will hear your bill in this committee and move it through. But we do need to have things introduced early in the session in order to do that and meet the first deadline.
Thank you, Representative Tingelstad and Representative Loffler. And at this time, Chair Tingelstad will resume the gavel. And I just want to make a personal note to welcome Representative Haas to the committee. He's been a tremendous asset to Strange County on the Commission's board. I've gotten to know him, and he looks great in a swimming suit in the dunk tank.
Well.
He is, but he is truly a great public servant, and I look forward to working with you.
Thank you.
Okay, members, thank you for the participating in that discussion. I appreciate that. We'll move on to the next agenda item, which is continuing appropriations legislation. And there's several other things in your packet related to that. We'll be hearing from Mark Shepard from House Research. Representative Greg Davids has a bill here. I believe it's Mark. Yeah, Davids. And then Representative Kahn. That's another bill. Some of these are identical or very similar. Representative Dempsey's bill. And then we have a bill draft here, too, that's marked. There's a kind of an interesting printout here from the Council of State Legislatures that I believe Mr. Shepard will be mentioning. And so I know it's a lot of information, but we thought we'd look at one of the top items that was on the survey related to continuing appropriations and see if we can start sort of grabbing hold of that issue and moving something through the legislature here at the beginning of the session. So with that, Mr. Shepard, I don't know if you're ready there to just kind of give us an overview continuing appropriations. I know you have a memo you put together for us here, and then we'll be hearing from a couple of the legislators. And where's that memo? I think it's marked at the top, GovOp, and it says continuing appropriations bill draft. Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and members, as you know, a number of legislators introduced bills during the special session to provide that certain appropriations would continue from one biennium to the next if the legislature hadn't introduced a new law. And Representative Tingelstedt asked me to try to work to put more detail on some of those bills. And so the draft that I have in your packet, it's just labeled MSHRD at the top, is my effort to do that. And these aren't all details that I've discussed or worked out with Representative Tingelstedt. I purposely put this not on the reviser system, but just in a Word format to indicate that this is really just some ideas that I put on paper for you all to discuss, not that it's any particular idea right now. So what I tried to do, and the memo that I have explains this, is to just sort of flesh out some of the detail on the concept of a continuing appropriation bill. And I'll quickly walk through the bill draft. The first subdivision one is the application section, and it starts with a notion that I put down just for you to consider, which is that the notion of a continuing appropriation would apply only to the major finance or revenue bills that you'd need to pass to avoid a state government shutdown. In other words, if there were minor appropriations that had been passed in other bills in other years, those wouldn't automatically continue from year to year under this. And adding a concept like this, of course, would require you to define what the major appropriation or revenue bills are, which the House and Senate currently do by rule. And obviously, it would be possible to just drop this concept totally and have the concept of continuing appropriation apply to all appropriations. I included it here just as a discussion item for you to consider. The next main concept of the bill is in Subdivision 2, and that provides, this is the core of the bill, it says that an appropriation from any fund that's enacted in a major finance or revenue bill would remain in effect at the base level for all future fiscal years unless it were changed, either repealed by law or amended by law. So the two main concepts here, either one of which you could change, are, first of all, that these appropriations would continue forever. Obviously, an alternative would be to have them continue just for one or more fiscal years instead of keeping them forever. The second main concept is that the appropriations would continue at the base level, presumably the same level as they were made in the past. The Subdivision 3, which is at the bottom of the first page and continuing all through the second page, is my attempt, which I've worked with Helen Roberts and Bill Marks from the fiscal staff on this, just to think about all the what it means to be a base level appropriation and some of the detailed circumstances in which everybody involved would probably say that that's not what we meant by a base level appropriation, and we really don't want this to continue exactly at the same level. So these are just a lot of details. The most obvious one would be if the legislature had passed a law one session and said X amount of money is appropriated, this is a one-time appropriation, that nobody would intend that that appropriation would then continue in the next year. And on page two, there's a variety of perhaps more technical circumstances in which I was thinking that you might want to consider adjustments to a continuing appropriation. This would be circumstances in which the accounting structure has changed, or duties have been transferred among agencies, or a program was new and it wasn't fully operational one year, just a variety of things in which somebody might think it appropriate to adjust what's considered the base level. So that's sort of the bulk of page two of this bill draft, Madam Chair. With that's the draft. I'd be happy to try to answer questions about this draft.
First question, Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shepard, you mentioned in the continuing appropriations bill draft on page 2 the interesting issues relating to the governor's unallotment authority. And I'm wondering if, you know, that's a very blunt instrument that had to be used in 2003 because we were spending, I don't know, it was $4 to $5 million per day more than we were bringing in out of the state treasury, and it had to be used. But my understanding, the way the unallotment authority works for the governor, is that he has to basically unallot the entire appropriation, that he cannot meter down 40% or 20% or what have you. Maybe Mr. Marks would know that more so, since you do more policy than appropriations. But wouldn't it make more sense if we gave the governor, in allotment situations, which is rare but sometimes necessary, and I think Governor Quay had to use it too, to allow some flexibility? I think, you know, the ethanol producer payments, remember, it was one that got wiped out for the rest of the fiscal year in 2003. Mm-hmm. And the governor's office told me, when some of the rural lawmakers questioned that they had an all-or-nothing choice, and that there were some other programs that would maybe take 2% out of or 8% out of and not wipe out an entire program, but an allotment didn't give them the authority to do that. Has there been any analysis of that, or has that just kind of been an area where we do it once every 18 years and we just kind of forget about it then?
Mr. Shepard?
Madam Chair and Representative Seifert, we have done some thinking about that, and the unallotment statute is not clear on any of the points that you mentioned. It's particularly unclear when you think about sort of aid payments to school districts, cities, counties, and the governor perhaps selectively unallotting payments to a particular unit of local government. On the House Research website, I've sort of, in conjunction with Joel Michael from our office, written a paper on this and tried to think through some of the ambiguities, and I can get you a copy of that if you like, but the short answer is those are all good questions and there aren't really clear answers. And the committee, if it is going to proceed with a continuing appropriation concept and we're concerned about how the unallotment authority would interact with that, I would suggest it might be a good time to relook at that statute and make it more specific in the way, whatever way you'd want it to be more specific.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we do move forward with this bill in the regular session, Madam Chair, I would like to have a little more thoughtful discussion about the unallotment process, because there were some of us that felt that there could have been a little bit more flexibility in how the governor used it. It is rather rare that it's used, but when it is, it's a very blunt instrument. And when I talked to Dan McElroy, who at that time was the finance commissioner, he said their choices were extremely limited in what they were able to do, that they had to wipe out entire amounts of something or just leave them alone. And I think as lawmakers, we could put a firewall around certain things and just say K-12 can't be touched, for example. Maybe the Department of Education could, but in terms of the formula for K-12 or nursing homes or something that we're sensitive to, but I just think it's somewhat silly in some situations where they couldn't take 1% of something because of how it was written. So I hopefully have a little more thought on that. I think it would be a little bit better government to have that.
Thank you, Representative Seifert. And actually, as it relates to our earlier discussion, I would hope that you maybe personally would take hold of that. You know, it sounds like an item, too, that would go through state government finance, your committee, and I'm sure you could probably find some other folks in our group here that would be happy to work with you on that unallotment issue. I know we have several questions. Next up, Representative Kahn.
Yes, well, Madam Chairman, thanks. It's interesting to see what happens when the kind of grocery clerks in the legislature do one sentence and what happens when the professionals get to it and really figure out how it's going to work. And my suggestion is that to give this more input, I suggest that you take this over and make it a committee bill, working from the Mark's draft and adding, I think, Marty's comments on the unallotment and checking out the website that we have on that and clearing up the unallotment process, including, I don't think we want to make it easier for unallotment to occur. We really want it only when it's shown, you know, when it's shown, because that's kind of like giving the governor partial line item veto. I don't think we want to go that route. But I think what he said makes sense, and I think the idea of making this a committee bill and making it a very early introduction as a committee bill would give it the kind of plat that committee bills used to have, at least.
You know, that would be my suggestion.
Good. We have several others. Next up, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is just really a quick question, or maybe it's a quick question for Mr. Shepherd. I just wanted a bit of history on the unallotment, but especially, is it constitutional or statutory, and how long has it been in effect?
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, the unallotment authority is statutory, and it has been used at least a couple of times. I believe that there was an agreement in the Perpich administration where the legislature 1 year adjourned without agreeing on things and allowed the governor to unallot. I don't recall exactly when the statute was enacted. It's been in effect at least 20, 30 years in that neighborhood, I think, and I'd have to look that up to be sure.
Okay. Next up, I guess, Representative Pond, did you have anything else?
No.
Anybody else? Okay. Mr. Shepherd, maybe if you could just give us the highlights of this NCSL handout. And I know there's confusion about terminology, continuing appropriations, continuing resolution, lights on. Maybe if you could kind of tell us the difference of those and how it relates to what's going on with other states. Mr. Shepherd.
Sure. Madam Chair and members, in your packets, there's a summary that the National Conference of State Legislatures prepared that looks like this, and it's an overview of other states' procedures of what happens if Appropriations Act is not passed by the beginning of a fiscal year. And they've got some main headings, which is the first one is the legislature passes a continuing resolution. This is similar to a procedure used in Congress often at the federal level. And you'll notice that there are some states that do that. The difference between that and what is in the draft bill that I did for today is that these are one time. And there were, you may recall, a number of these bills introduced in the special session this June where people were suggesting the so-called lights on approach, where a continuing resolution would authorize spending to occur at a base level for a week, a month, whatever period of time was necessary. So you can see there are some states that have those. There are, in the second column, there are some states where certain payments are continuous, and Minnesota is one of these. I was speaking with Ms. Roberts before the meeting, and if you looked at our general fund budget in Minnesota, there are some very big payments that are continuous in the sense that they are made in statute, and unless the legislature changed the statute, they would continue. The biggest of those is the K-12 basic education aid. That continues. I think the second biggest is local government aid. And another example is the funding that's needed to pay off the debt service on state general obligation bonds. If you total all those, it amounts to something close to half of the state general fund budget is already on a continuing basis. The other columns are things that basically say government shuts down until a budget is enacted or there's nothing going on. If you look at the very back of the table, there's some sort of footnotes and a bit more detail on other states, and I thought I'd just highlight about four or five of these that are sort of different options from all the rest. The first one is Illinois, where they have a procedural change in that until June 1st, a simple majority in each house is required to pass the budget, and after that date, a 3/5 vote is required. So that's something that they do a little bit differently. In Maryland, the Constitution provides for a budget to be enacted by the 83rd day of a 90-day session, and if it's not, then no other pending legislation can be considered. So it just says you can only do the budget. Rhode Island has, I think, what is the most... Rhode Island and Wisconsin are the two states based on this that appear to have a system most similar to what is being considered today. Where if the legislature has not passed the bill, the appropriations continue at the base level. Washington makes it a misdemeanor for the legislature not to pass a budget. So, something different. And West Virginia has a provision that automatically extends session if the budget isn't passed at a certain point. and during the extended session, only the budget can be considered. So, Madam Chair, those are just some different ideas in other states that that stood out to me as different approaches.
Great, thank you. Any questions on that? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Shepard. I'd like to bring forward Representative Greg Davids. He has one of the bills that's in your packet, and I think there's a couple of them that are fairly close, if not identical, but let's hear from Chairman Davids here about his ideas on what we can do better. Welcome to our committee.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I have my continuing resolution bill, which is very simple. I have studied this thoroughly and have patterned it after Guam, Puerto Rico, and the Northern Mariana Islands that we have here. Actually, I think Mr. Shepard was correct when he said it was probably closest to what Wisconsin does. As you know, after what we went through in 2005, I thought that that was something that we should not have done. All the years that I've been here, we never really, I guess we might have come close a few times, but we never actually did it. And my bill is very simple, a very short bill, and just very simply says that if we can't come to a budget agreement, we continue the previous budget, biennium budget, and we continue forward. Now, the arguments on the other side are, well, if you have, if the Davids bill passes, there'll be no reason to settle a budget, and I wholeheartedly disagree in that during special sessions or shutdowns, I'm sure that you've had the same experiences I have had when you go home. People are strongly encouraging you to come to a resolution and get the job done, and I think that would be the case with or without the Davids bill. But I would appreciate this committee's support when we get into session. I'd like this, if we could, you know, have it heard very quickly and move forward. It's very simple. It just says if we can't come to an agreement, we continue. And my concern has been with the townships, counties, cities, and school boards. How do they plan anything when they don't even know if we're open for business? At least this way we're open for business and we can continue and then we can get the numbers settled. And sometimes it'll take a long time. You know, Texas, I don't even know if they settled their 2005 budget yet. I'm not sure, but you didn't hear of any government shutdowns. They continued. Wisconsin continues. It's common for state legislatures these days to not get their budgets done on time. And if we change it from what state was it that had a misdemeanor, Mr. Shepard?
Washington.
We might want to make it a felony. I'm not sure what we should do here. But with that being said, I'd stand for questions, Madam Chair, and it's a very straightforward bill.
Questions for Representative Davids? Okay. Well, thank you. I know that this was January early bill introduction. Is that right?
Yes. I introduced it right during special session in 05, but then reintroduced it right away in 06.
Okay. So we'll get this on the agenda for one of our early hearings in March. So
maybe there'll be a hearing request on your desk March 1st.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Hopps.
Yeah, I would like to hear some more discussion on, or maybe somebody else's comments on, if the fact if you didn't get the job done, it's going to be what it was. Why is that not going to motivate not doing anything? Not doing anything is a decision. You have a funding scale that you're going back to. That may be satisfactory to an awful lot of people. And so if they delay it and delay it, they end up with a decision that they wanted, which was no change. I would like to hear some of the experienced senators and representatives address that for me, please.
Well,
really. We'll vote to drink. Thank you.
We'll put that into the budget bill. Well, clearly, the you know, we always want to change the budget. We wouldn't sit and meet in all these times if
exactly.
We didn't. So there is, you know, and if the majority doesn't want to change it, then that's what should happen. I mean, that's what sometimes happens in some of the ones. Usually the governor puts a budget in, and I've never seen a governor put a budget saying, just keep everything going just the way it was. There's usually something they want to increase or something they want to decrease. So there is, you know, and so I absolutely don't buy the fact that you need pressure of forcing a shutdown to come to a decision. And if the decision is to let everything keep going, that still has to be a majority decision, and it's still a decision. One of the things I want to point out is that there's a a lot of unaccounted costs of shutdown. We can ask for what the costs of shutdown were, and you'll get things about shutting down and reopening and vacation and non-vacation and that stuff. But what you have to understand is that state government essentially shut down for the last few weeks while it looked like we were approaching a shutdown. The amount of effort that went into planning for a shutdown and thinking about a shutdown and just people's emotional efforts about, oh, I have a vacation planned, you know, with my extended family for August, and now it looks like I'm going to have to take it in July. How do I do that? I mean, those costs that we'll never have were very real costs of shutdown. I don't know if there's any way to quantify it, but, you know, I just think, and the other fact that I'd like to put out, I'll put it a factoid because it only means that I'm remembering it, is that as I understood it, at the end of the fiscal year last year, there are at least 5 or 6 states that didn't come to a budget agreement, and only one state shut down. And that's not a record, I think, that we want to keep in the future.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess the question I would have to the author of the bill here, and this basically says that the budget continues as is. Would you be open to a friendly amendment that says that as it continues on, then the budget is resolved at a further date, that there is no provision for retroactively funding the new budget for those dates that have been cut into the new cycle? Does that make sense?
Madam Chair, Representative Severson, that does make some sense. It would be the intention of this bill that you continue funding until the new budget. There probably should be something put in there about what the legislature feels about retroactivity to when it should have been done. That's something I'd have to give some more thought to, and I'd be happy to work with you on that. But is that kind of where you're going, that if it actually gets settled August 15th, do we necessarily, if there's an increase in a certain area, do we want to go back to the 1st of July and implement that increase? Or do you just go from August 15th on?
Madam Chair.
Representative, sir.
Yeah, that would be my bent on it, because I don't believe that there's any incentive for a resolution unless there's some penalty for it, and I believe that the penalty would be such that if you've got bills that have come forward that have been heard to get the issue resolved and get those monies enacted, you need to do it by the required time, which would be 1 July. If that doesn't happen, then the incentive becomes those appropriations can't be realized until that budget is passed. And I think that would be incentive on both sides to say my program is resolved, I want to get this thing passed. If I don't, I'm going to pay a penalty for it. Just a thought.
Representative David.
Thank you for that. That'll deserve some consideration here.
Okay, we have one other one. Representative Seifert, and then we'll get to you, Representative Dempsey.
Madam Chair, I just want to walk through a scenario on how this would work, and maybe Mr. Shepard would be the best one to answer or represent David's, but let's just go back to 2003 when we were out of balance by, say, $4.5 billion, give or take a few million. And one of the bills that we don't think of as a budget bill but is the tax bill, because that's where the appropriations for local government aid go through. And so there's both collections and appropriations made out of the tax bill. So let's walk through the scenario and assume that all of the divisions pass their bill in conference committee, higher ed, K-12, state government finance, environment, ag, etc. We have 9 of the 10 finance bills finished, and we are almost to balance. And then the tax committee, I'm trying to think of the senator who's chair of that, it's Larry, isn't it? No, I wouldn't put this, you know, beyond anything he would think of, but, you know, let's just say that the Senate conference committee walks out knowing that this provision is in law. Let's say we passed this in 2002 instead of now. And that's not a majority decision not to do something. You know, that's 3 of 5 people deciding to walk out of a room, which they have the right to do in a conference committee. Let's say it's about May 19th or so and the clock is ticking. We are still out of balance by $350 million. The law says that the appropriations all remain in effect. And because local government aid was supposed to go backward by $350 million for the biennium, what happens? The law says that the appropriations still have to take place, but the Constitution has forces us to have a balanced budget and forces us not to go into short-term borrowing for the general fund. under that scenario, if this were the law in 2003 and that were the scenario that was the case, what would have happened? Because one is working against the other. Does everybody follow what I'm asking?
Exactly.
What's the comment? Mr. Shepherd, do you want to represent? Let's go with Shepherd first here. Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative Seifert, and here are, I guess, it would depend a lot on the timing first. And I'm obviously thinking out loud on this. I'm not sure what would have happened. But first of all, if all of the appropriation bills had passed, but the governor still had an opportunity to veto one or more of them, then the governor could item veto items of expenditure out of, you know, one or more of those bills. Under the current system, if that occurred, the governor would be able to, if the governor item vetoed an item of expenditure, it would be gone totally. Under this system, as I understand it, if it were in place, if the governor item vetoed an appropriation, it would remain in effect at the current level. So it would be a little bit different in that sense. On the tax, if all of the appropriation bills had passed and the tax bill had not passed, and then the budget was out of balance by more than the amount that was in the budget reserve, then the governor would be required to unallot, and the unallotment law would then kick in. So the governor would be required to make the changes necessary to bring the budget into balance.
So, that, Madam Chair, to that point, I think that would probably get back to my previous point that we should give a little more flexibility in unallotment, so we're not wiping out a whole division of local government aid or what have you, just in case this happened. I've been thinking about this. I think it's a good bill to prevent shutdown. It's probably the only one that really prevents the or solves the issue that Representative Dempsey was talking about. But I think as we do this, we need to think about all these different scenarios and make sure that we don't end up with something where we really have a big mess. I think all of us want a balanced budget. Look at the federal government, what a disaster that is under both regimes. I think it would be good to think about how to make the mechanisms work so we don't get into something that is an unintended consequence. That's the reason we have committees, and we'll have to think about this one a little bit more. But I like the idea of having some mechanism that you can make both work at the same time, and probably flexible on allotment. I think in the federal government they call it rescissions, but some type of a mechanism to make this work so we don't have a situation where, you know, we're having the governor line item veto 2/3 of the higher ed bill because there's just no money left.
Madam Chair?
Good point.
To that point, and Chairman Seifert brings up a very good point. The bill seems to go on autopilot if the economies are doing well and the tax collections are even or higher, then it works fine. But then the question is, what happens if we have a continuing resolution and tax collections are down, and we're in a downward swing? And exactly as Mr. Shepherd said, that's what would have to happen, and that could have some negative consequences if he has to take out entire areas of the budget. So I hope this committee will also look at partial unallotments or things such as that.
Mm-hmm. To this point, Representative.
Well, actually, I hate to differ from Mr. Shepherd, who's clearly much more knowledgeable than I am, but I do believe that if an item has been passed in the budget bill and then the governor has vetoed it, that we then have changed that appropriation by law. So I do think that it would not continue, that it's become law, they'll have to be passed, signed by the governor, and if the governor vetoes it, then we've clearly ended the appropriation. We've ended the appropriation by law. And I think, okay, I'm not going
to
be wrong.
Do you want to comment?
Well, we have to do notwithstanding, Mark, for that.
Mm-hmm.
We have to put notwithstanding in front of the...
I think, Madam Chair and members, this I don't either agree or disagree with Representative Kahn. Generally, I think that I've been thinking about this in our office and with Ms. Roberts, and it's sort of it's just a new system, and I think the point is everybody would have to think through it. My sense on the specific question that Representative Kahn raised would be that if you had an appropriation in law that was set to continue, like the current K-12 education appropriation, and the legislature passed bills that either increased it or decreased it, but the governor didn't sign that bill, then in my opinion, the law is still in place. In order for the legislature to change anything, it wouldn't be enough that the House or the Senate
right.
passed something. You'd have to have the governor sign it, too.
Right. But I'm saying it's a different. I completely agree if the governor doesn't sign the bill. But I think it's different if the governor signs the bill and vetoes something. But maybe it's just the change. That wouldn't be in effect. And one of the things when you say about not passing the tax bill, remember the tax bill is the only bill that we don't have to pass. If the tax bill does totally continue, goes on autopilot. Mm-hmm. If we don't, there's very little things in the tax bill that stop the way appropriations stop.
Sounds like we need to give this more thought and look at some different situations. I know we have a couple members with questions or comments here. I believe Representative Dempsey here.
Well, there are two things that motivated me in regard to the legislation, the state, I think, has an obligation to its employees. And when we have a situation like this where people are doing what is the expectation and all the rest of that, that when you say to people that your job is going to be eliminated, I think is not good public policy at all. From my point of view, it would be morally wrong to do that. Now, you can legitimize anything, but I think when you take a person's job away from them when they're doing that particular position, and that was the motivation that affected me in regard to that. And the second thing that I would say is I think it's good to have the various points of view from David's and Representative Kahn and myself and the staff. I think from these four pieces of legislation, we can come up with a good piece of legislation that's going to solve the problem. And then you don't, you know, it'll solving problems are things to do rather than just financing them, and they blow up and they're, well, that's not good. Well, we'll try something else. Let's solve the problem, and with this piece of legislation and the other two or three pieces of legislation, we can solve the problem and get it done. And that's what we're here to do.
Good point. Thank you. Next up, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this isn't going to be an easy one to solve, and if I can lend any of my thoughts to this discussion, is that this is incredibly more complicated than these four rather simple-looking bills would lead us to believe. There's a principle that I'd like to encourage us to hew to, and that's the principle that spending comes from this body, the House. The ability to spend or not spend is ours. That's the Constitution. Whatever we do, let's protect that. I think it's important that we do move forward to protect that principle so we don't get in the sticky wicket we were in last time, where we have bipartisanly asked the Supreme Court to intervene on whether or not the executive branch can just take over and fix the mess that we made. We need to own that. And making that mess, yes, I haven't met you yet. I'm Representative Mike Beard. You are?
Representative Haas.
Representative Haas, yeah,
much
good
like
point.
Here.
That, okay.
Yes.
Oh, boy, now I'm going to be confused.
If you just remember one of our names and look at it, that'll
okay.
be fine.
It's a counterpart of Liebling and Leffler.
Oh, no. Where was I, Madam Chair?
And that's why
Representative Beard.
Thank you. The good point that was made, though, was that we don't want to fall into that trap again of having courts and the executive branch decide stuff that's our responsibility, and we need to own it. Sometimes making those decisions is the decision. Though, as we're talking about this, though, just one more thing to contemplate in this fascinating discussion as we're all being educated is this. At federal level, there's a thing called a pocket veto. Legislature passes a bill, the president doesn't like it, he doesn't actually have to kill it, he just doesn't sign it. I think it's just the opposite here, however. If we pass a bill and the governor doesn't like it, he actually has to sign it to kill it, I believe. If he doesn't sign it, it becomes law, which may affect some of the things we're thinking about when we're passing our individual committee bills and we send them over there, depending on the timing. After what period of day is it, Mr. Shepherd? Three? Just three short days. They actually become...
Right.
Okay, now I'm getting some answers. But anyhow, after all that statement, there's a question there that may be helpful to this discussion. I look for that answer.
Okay, let's get that on record there, the difference between whether we're in session or out of session number of days. Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and members, Representative Beard, that the governor, the time that the governor has to veto a bill that's presented to him varies depending on whether you're at the end of the biennial session or not. If the legislature presents a bill at any time during the session, the general rule is the governor has 3 days after presentment to sign the bill or to veto it, rather, and that, or it becomes law.
Mm-hmm.
But the rules are different for bills that are passed during the last 3 days of a biennial session. So in the even-numbered year, and I'm not citing this exactly right, but if the bill is passed during the last 3 days, the governor has 14 days to consider it. And then if he doesn't sign it, I believe that is vetoed at the end. That rule only applies in the last 3 days of an even-numbered year.
So it reverses, Madam Chair? It reverses, and he actually does have pocket veto authority on the last 3 days of an even-numbered year. Is there going to be a test on this? Seriously, though, this is an important thing that we need to remember, because we're weighing out the effects of retaining legislative authority over spending and taxation issues. These are the important things for us to know.
Good point. Okay, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Beard's point, I think that passing the Davids-Kahn or Dempsey bill does give us more authority and more control, if you will, because there's no reason for anything to go to the courts. We just continue as we were, and we wouldn't have the situation that we had in 2005.
Point. And with that, members, you also have copies of the Kahn and Dempsey bill, and I think the only differences are the effective date or lack of effective date or whatever. Representative Kahn, maybe if you'd like to make comments about your bill or
I think the comment that I made, I thought that the Shepherd revision, the Shepherd whatever, rewriting or so forth was totally appropriate. I also like the idea of the Seifert consideration of unallotment. You know, I'm not quite sure how we want to do it is okay, and I think we need a thorough understanding of how it all fits in with the constitutional requirement to have a balanced budget and the and what the size of the budget reserve is and all of that stuff. So, as I said, I go back to what I first said, but I like the idea of doing a committee bill based on the Shepherd version.
And Representative Dempsey, do you want to make comments on your bill?
No, I think we've had enough comments. I think now what we have to do is to get on with the out of those four pieces of bills, let's get working on getting it so that it'll be passable in both the House and Senate.
Okay, thank you. I encourage members to be talking to each other on this one. Representative Davids, go for it, and see if we can get some good things out of this.
Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. Okay, members, next up on the agenda is House File 58, Representative Seifert's bill. It's in your packet. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, House File 58 is from the special session. It's something that I'm going to have to reintroduce that the staff has told me special session bills canceled. So it's basically a two-word bill that closes a loophole that I think had unanimous or bipartisan agreement last session. Unfortunately, we didn't have special sessions when the ethics laws originally passed back in, well, we had them, but not nearly as frequently as we recently have. Members, the law right now states that members cannot solicit or accept PAC or lobbyist contributions during a regular session. This bill adds or special session to the law. I have to compliment the many members who could have taken money during the 2005 special session when we had a lot of important bills that had a lot of special interest involvement. In fact, the House DFL had a fundraiser scheduled. Representative Tenza said that they voluntarily turned away donations from PACs and lobbyists just to keep everything above board. But I think in the future, as legislators change and times change, if there are special sessions that pop up, that certainly we don't think it's appropriate for a legislator, you know, within 1 hour to be taking numerous PAC and lobbyist checks from people who have an interest before the legislature in an immediate sense.
and then turn around and vote on the floor an hour later. I don't think anyone is for that. We had some brief discussion about this during special. Leadership said at that point the special session was kind of wrapping up. We had an agreement that was informal on both sides that members were not going to solicit and accept PAC and lobbyist money. And so what this would do is just make this the permanent law, and in my opinion, we start special session. This could be a consent calendar item. I don't see it as controversial. I don't know of anybody who's opposed to it.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Seifert. In the Navy, we had a thing called the NATOPS, Navy Operation Training Manual, and every pilot was required to read and memorize a lot of this thing because it was written in the blood of previous pilots. And a lot of times when we get into the session, that's what we find out is that there are intricacies that happen in new situations, and I think this is a great example of something that you brought forward here that needs to be tweaked. Representative Kahn.
Well, at the risk of saying that no one should disagree with it, I point out that I guess I disagree with it just because of the difficulty of planning special sessions. And I think it was appropriate that the House voluntarily did it. But when you look at the effort that goes in advance into planning a fundraiser, when there's no reason to believe that there should be a special session. I heard Katie Sieben last night when asked to say something that people maybe didn't know about her, was that she got married the last week of the special session and she didn't advise anyone to do that. I mean, the thing is, you can't plan one's life around special sessions. And I'm just a little you know, and obviously it's very easy for anyone to just not accept individual contributions and to say you are. But if major events have been planned, you know, it can't. It's perfectly okay to stop them voluntarily, but to stop them by law, I don't think is a good idea. I just don't think it's, you know, I just think, obviously, when we said that we don't raise money during a session, the intent to not raise it during special session is there too, and I think that that's all we need. I don't think we need a law to.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, the bill is strictly kept in adherence with our current practices. You can have a fundraiser. You can solicit money from anybody you want, except lobbyists and PACs who have issues pending before the legislature and be voted on, basically. And if I'm not mistaken, I think the fundraising event still went on. It's just that they took money from other people of various, you know, private interests or what have you. But I just think if you have someone who's a registered lobbyist or a PAC, and I don't take PAC or lobbyist money all year, ever, during session, out of session, special session, and I do fine taking from the little old ladies and whatever else that give me $5 or $10 apiece. So if a bumpkin like myself can raise the full amount to spend for the legislature at $30,000 and not take a penny from any PACs or lobbyists throughout the entire biennium, I would think that the rest of us could just not take it during, you know, the month or month and a half. It might be another incentive not to have a special session, but it's not to disparage anyone. It's just to say I don't think that our dependence on PAC and lobbyist money is that much that we have to take it during a special session. I really don't. And if we have some type of fundraiser plan, invite everybody. But, you know, the lobbyists and PAC people are just going to have to wait until whenever the special session adjourns. So, you know, in talking to some of the folks who written the original law, I think they probably wanted special included. I don't remember if I talked to Mindy Greiling about this or not. She was one that had a lot of involvement with this. So, you know, certainly people can differ, and I'm not going to question anybody's motives on why it might be a bad idea, but I haven't heard a lot of people say it's been a bad idea.
Okay, a couple members with questions. First up, Representative Seibert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is to Representative Kahn's comment. Last thing I care about is one of my fundraisers when something like this happens. You mentioned people that had to cancel their vacations because we shut down government. I canceled my family vacation because we had a special session. Those things are important to people, but we had to get our job done. The last thing I was worried about is any fundraisers I had, and I think this is a good addition, I think it should be part of the law. If we're going to say that we can't take money during the regular session, I think the special session is part of the regular session if we make it so. So the last thing we should be worried about is our fundraisers and if we can do them or not, because we should be here getting the special session completed.
Representative Khan.
This doesn't deal with the gift ban at all, which I guess is totally on all time. I'm just thinking of the time that Becky Kelso was having serious surgery for cancer, and the entire corridor was filled with flowers that had to be returned because they had or she had to pay for them. The original solution was that she was supposed to pay for all the flowers that were sent for them. And I think Tom Kellum's comment was great, was that he wasn't going to take back the candles he had lit in the Catholic Church for that. But, I guess the gift ban, which is something really weird when you look at it in those kinds of situations, applies for more than just sessions. Mm. So,
to this point, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Khan, I'm glad you brought that up because it gets to a point that I was trying to formulate in my mind about the honor of this institution. And really, that's what the Seifert Bill is about. Banning lobbyists during special session, I think, protects the honor of this institution. Conversely, some of the things we've done with the gift ban have assaulted the honor and integrity of this institution because of exactly what happened in the Representative Kelso case. I was the House District Chair that was responsible for trying to find people to run against Becky every 2 years because she was my representative. A friend, an honorable person, but when she came up with ovarian cancer, the local Republican Party sent meals to her home. Our party lawyer said, you can't do that. So we had to cross Becky's name off of the card and give it to her husband. Because we sent meals ready to eat that he could just nuke and feed the boys.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how absurd it got. And that reflects poorly on the honor and integrity of this institution. That is a separate issue, and I welcome a discussion to engage that kind of foolishness someday. But in this case, I have to disagree with Representative Khan that, yes, it is a nuisance when you're trying to plan big events, but still, I'd encourage members to consider the honor and integrity of the institution, and this seems to be a small change that helps in some small way protect that.
Well, I'll gladly trade this one if we fix up the gift ban so that we don't have those stupidities in it.
I'm with you, sister.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I don't have any problem with this. I think it's fine for legislators who are continuing to serve. And I hope that we never have as long a special session as we just had. I mean, that's pretty unusual as I understand it. But I noticed that the language also refers to people who are running for a county, city, or town office. And I always think you have to look at unanticipated consequences. And if, for example, Representative Dempsey, who has announced that he is not going to be running for re-election, is approached by his peers in his community and they say, you know, we would really love to have you on the library board or something else, and would you consider running for that? And here we are in special session until mid-July. You know, does that cramp people who want to do municipal service? And I'm thinking particularly in the situation of a retirement. So it's not like they're raising money related to their future legislative efforts or something. And it's probably something that wouldn't happen very often, but I do know our senior members are often tapped for local service after they leave legislative service, and so I just wonder if you thought about that, Representative Seifert.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I haven't, but I do know that there are some legislators who switch to the county board, particularly the metro area, where it pays a lot more and the workload's probably about one-tenth of what a legislator is. And nobody knows who you are and you never get attacked for anything, but it would be interesting to be a metro.
Here I am, Jack.
Metro county.
Oh, thank you, sir.
The one thing, though, is if you have a PAC, you know, this is only PACs and lobbyists. This is not individuals. This is not your just regular folk. This is people who have an interest before the legislature. And so if you have someone who comes before you and says, by the way, I have a $500 check for you while you're serving in office, you know, I'm not saying that's going to sway anybody or not, but if you're running for another office, maybe they have business before the whatever county board that they have before the legislature, I don't know. But I just think the only reason it's drafted that way is for uniformity. I think Deb McKnight drafted it just to try to make it as easy as possible to understand. And I think if members just know, if you're an incumbent member of the legislature, if we're in session, you don't take PAC and lobbyist money because they have interests that before us that, you know, Phyllis, you probably remember the days when they had people standing outside the gates, you know, and there's been a lot of reforms since the 1970s that have taken place, I think. You know, they used to have the governor's staff running around on the House floor, my understanding, you know, telling people how to vote. And, you know, we reform these things gradually, time after time, and I think this is just one more gradual reform that makes a lot of sense. I really don't think that any incumbent member of the legislature is going to forget about this if we pass this, and it's part of our legislator training, just like it is now, you know, during regular session. Everybody knows that you don't accept it, and you send it back if it's given.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Seifert, you know, I guess I have reservations about whether we really need to do this, but that said, I do support it because I think it has a lot to do with appearance of impropriety.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, frankly, I think our campaign finance laws, at least on the level of our particular elections, are very good. And I think the limitation on PAC contributions is very good because, you know, frankly, I don't know how much influence somebody can really buy for $500. I mean, come on, you know. But I think it's important that we think about the integrity of this institution and how the public perceives us. And for that reason, I think that, you know, I will support this.
Representative Seifert, anything else?
No, Madam Chair. I think I'm going to have this because of the special session. I thought it was introduced during regular, but it was during special session. So if any members want to sign on as co-authors, we'll have this jacketed quickly. And then I don't know if the operating procedure, like with the other bills, that we're just going to have a very quick hearing and refer it on to the next committee or to the floor or whatever.
Ideally, Representative Seifert, because we're spending time on it today, you know, certainly things may change. There may be amendments at that time, but that was the whole idea with having today's hearing.
Right.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Seifert. I want to thank you for introducing this, and actually I have a bill that's drafted right in here, too, and I apologize for the duplication because I have some very strong opinions about duplicative bills and how they're introduced. But I would almost want to take this one step further, but I also know the reality is that, you know, we don't allow individual contributions during session two. We know how there's encouragement or solicitation by lobbyists or PACs to have their clients and individual employees or whatnot to make contributions to the candidate's campaign. And that is, you know, influence that's directed to a legal source of contribution. So it's, you know, I do think that this is a problem and that it does need to be addressed. With that said, I just have one question under subdivision one, and I just thought of this now. It appears that any candidate for the legislator during session cannot solicit money from PACs or lobbyists. Do I have the interpretation correct?
Representative Seifert.
Madam Chair, it is a candidate for the legislature constitutional office. And then they add in the political party groups like the House DFL Caucus, House Republican Caucus, etc. That's under sub one. The campaign finance board has kind of a lugubrious bunch of rules that our treasurers have to abide by, but this would probably be just one more item that would be added to the list that, you know, during special session you can't do it. And I think that's mainly because of trying to be uniform in how they treat people, that, you know, you aren't going to have your opponent can run and take $5,000, whatever the limit is, and you're kind of hamstrung because you happen to be an incumbent. So I like the idea of just everybody treated equally and not having two sets of rules.
Okay. Anything further on that?
Nothing further. I completely agree with Representative Seifert.
Mm-hmm. Good. Like to see that teamwork. Okay. Thank you, Representative Seifert. We'll get that on the agenda in our March meeting. So, members, we're moving on to item 7 on the agenda here, rulemaking. And there's some information in your packet from the research department on this. And I know we had a little bit of discussion about this at one of our fall meetings, and I wanted to get into more detail. And I know especially Representative Kahn and Representative Seifert have both done quite a bit of work on rulemaking in the past, and I've asked Mr. Shepard to make some comments and kind of some clarifications on this issue. As you know, I'm new to this committee, as is almost everyone else from the committee. Actually, it's only Representative Kahn and Representative Seifert have ever served on GovOps before. And I'm finding out more and more during the interim just how important rulemaking is in the amount of mail I get to my office. And I just want to make sure that we are doing the appropriate work as the GovOps committee in watching that rulemaking. And what I'm finding is just about every state agency and department sends information on any of their updates. And as we know, a lot of things are done through the agencies through rulemaking, and sometimes we get calls from constituents that say perhaps an agency or department went too far in rulemaking, that they're almost stepping over into the line of legislative changes, lawmaking changes. And so, Mr. Shepard, I just wanted to kind of turn it over to you to review the packet, and then, you know, I have some questions as regards to our responsibilities, maybe as individual members of GovOps, and how much we should be following rulemaking, and just like to kind of get the committee more educated on this whole issue. And Representative Seifert, Representative Kahn, as more experienced legislators in this area, please feel free to jump in and add some clarification or comments as it's appropriate. So let's start with Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair and members, I thought I could briefly do two things. One is just to summarize the law that passed last year that's new in this area. And second, I can mention there are three sections of current law under which certain agency rulemaking actions need to be reported to legislative standing committees. And I thought I could briefly review those, which is one sort of an institutional way in statute that the legislature reviews rules. First of all, in your packet, as Representative Tinglestad noted, I've just summarized the one law that Representative Seifert was the chief author of this that was enacted last year that deals with certain rules that are going to require legislative approval before they're fully implemented. And this law, which passed as part of the state government finance bill, says that if the proposed cost in the first year after implementation of a state agency rule would exceed $25,000 for any one small business or any one small city, then that business or city can file a statement basically exempting itself from that rule until such time as the legislature passed the law that says the rule applies to you. And there are some exceptions to this and some administrative requirements. But basically the concept is that small businesses and small cities won't be subject to certain costly rules unless the legislature comes back and says that they are. So that, Madam Chair, is the one bill that it went through this committee last year, and then it was incorporated in the state government finance bill. Madam Chair, I then just briefly mentioned there are three parts of current law, longstanding parts of the law that under which the legislature gets some information from agencies about rules under certain circumstances. First of all, when an agency proposes rules, an administrative law judge has to review those rules, and they review them to make sure that all the procedures were followed, to make sure that they're legal, and also to make sure that the agency has shown that the rules are needed and reasonable. There's a requirement in law that if an administrative law judge disapproves a rule at the tail end of the process and says it's not legal or you didn't follow the right procedures or it's not needed and reasonable, they have to send a report, basically just a notice, to the chairs of the primary legislative committees that have jurisdiction over that agency so that those committee chairs would then know that this has happened, that there's been some proposed rules that the administrative law judge has disapproved. And so these are, most of the disapprovals are on fairly technical bases, but there are reports that are submitted. Mr. Neske gave me one yesterday that had been submitted last spring based on some rules that applied to the Housing Finance Agency where the administrative law judge had disapproved them and then sent notice to the appropriate committee chairs with a document showing that why they were disapproved. The second kind of report that comes to the legislature is you have required all agencies to report annually to the legislature if they have any obsolete, unnecessary, or duplicative rules. And these are typically one-page reports in which the agency says either we've identified the following rules that we believe are obsolete, unnecessary, or duplicative, or we don't have any. And most of them say that they don't have any. One of the major substantive effects of these is that if an agency identifies certain rules as obsolete, unnecessary, or duplicative, they can then follow a very expedited process to get rid of those rules. It's very quick. And so the reason these come to the legislative chairs is that there may be some things that an agency thinks are obsolete that the legislature might not think are obsolete. And so this is sort of a routine report that goes to the committee chairs so that you all would have an opportunity to make sure you agree with the agency before they go through this very, very quick process of getting rid of the expedited rules. Getting rid of the obsolete rules. I've never heard of an abuse of this. I've never heard of an agency trying to use this to get rid of to ditch some controversial rules. And I think it's pretty much where these rules can be repealed quickly without having to go through a costly process to get rid of them. But the reports are there. All these are filed in the reference library, too, if you're interested. The final kind of report is that when any agency, when it is adopting any rules, is now required to, when it gives notice of intent to adopt the rules, to send a copy of that notice and a copy of what's called the Statement of Need and Reasonableness. Those have to be sent to the chairs and ranking minority party members of the policy and budget committees with jurisdiction over the subject matter of the rules. I believe Representative Seifert offered this law a few years ago, if I'm not mistaken. And obviously the intent of this is that the key legislators would get notice that an agency is implementing rules in their subject area. If I remember correctly, these notices at one time may have gone to all of the authors and co-authors, which I think was thought to be duplicative. Many of them weren't in the legislature anymore, and there are too many co-authors in the House now. So now it just goes to the chairs and ranking minority members every time an agency is mailing intent to adopt rules. And that concludes my thoughts, Madam Chair.
Okay, appreciate that. Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, Mr. Shepherd. Whenever the chair and the ranking minority member are notified that an agency is up to something in the rulemaking area, what recourse does the committee chair or that ranking minority member have? Is it just an enlightenment procedure, or is there approval required, or does it give us an opportunity to act or react, or what was the purpose behind whoever instituted that?
Mr. Shepherd?
Was that Mr. Seifert, perhaps?
No, it was. Madam Chair, part of that bill that is in addition to the ranking member and the chair getting notice, if Mark, you might remember this, the committee can hold up the rule. It has to be each body voting, but if we had a rule relating to the Veterans Affairs Department that we felt was not in the best interest of veterans, for example, the chair, and then who's the ranking member on this committee? Is it Phyllis?
Mm-hmm.
Would either one could bring this forward to the committee, and then we could vote, if a majority of this committee would vote to hold it up, and then the designated committee in the Senate could, and then the bill is held up. Basically, the rules are held up then, and that was the reason, was we don't want agencies making laws, we want lawmakers making laws, and the rules have the effect of law. So I thought it was a good thing to bring it back to the committee to say, hey, is this legislative intent or is it not? And it would have to have a pretty high threshold because it would be House and Senate. Does that sound right, Mark?
Mr. Shepard?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Seifert, yes, that's exactly right. This was a law that was passed in 2001. I don't think it's ever been used.
Not yet.
But it does allow the, by a majority vote of the Standing Committee of the House and the Senate with jurisdiction, can advise an agency that a rule shouldn't be adopted, and then the agency can't adopt the rule until the legislature adjourns the annual session that begins after the committee took the vote.
Oh.
So this is a tricky area of sort of constitutional relations mm-hmm. between the executive and the legislature. It's pretty well decided that a committee of the legislature can't veto a rule or can't repeal an existing rule, but it was thought at the time that it would be possible as part of the rulemaking process to just delay the rule, to tell an agency, not that the legislative committees would be vetoing it, but that it would be delayed until the legislature had a chance to look at it. So that is the law in the books.
Mr. Shepard, what's the citation on that?
Madam Chair, that is section 14.126.
So we had a couple other members with questions. Representative Seifert, did you want to comment on that?
Madam Chair, I was going to say in the big memo that Mark has has a research department on the front, there are a couple other items that members might be interested in relating to rules and mandates on page 8 at the bottom. There's two items that you might have of interest. One is a hybrid of what Representative Olson had on his mandate relief deal. It says under other governmental operations issues, and that one is if a local government finds mandates they don't like, and that can be either rule or law, either one, that they can object to the mandate and put it on the send it to the state auditor. And we weren't real sure. Representative Olson had a kind of a longer process that involved the legislature, but we thought at least this was something the Senate was willing to give me. And we found, I think it was 200 resolutions, because somebody said, oh, nobody's going to do any resolutions. And state auditor's office, I mean, they're getting inundated with requests from local governments and mandate relief. And that could either be a rule or a law. And so if you members have any local governments who are upset about rules or laws that want to object to something, send them to the state auditor's website and they can object for free. Generally, the resolution has to be passed by the county board or the city council or the school board, but at least they've got a mechanism now. And I'm planning on kind of making a collated report for members to look at and say, hey, we need to deal with this stuff, because they really haven't had a mechanism to really do anything before. So I want to thank Representative Olson for putting the big bill in, and we at least got something that I think is tangible now. And then below that is the rule and law waiver request. This is Representative Beard's bill, where one or more local governments can request a waiver, an exemption from a law or a rule, and then the state auditor will act on the waiver request. And this used to be the Government Innovation Cooperation mm-hmm. Board that did this, but we abolished that board. And so now the state auditor has the authority to do rule waivers if there's something that makes sense, in her opinion, that's an undue burden on local government. So we do have two items that kind of relate to rules. It's not really rule-making process like Mark was covering, but at least it somewhat relates to this. So if members have any town meetings or meetings with your local government officials between now and whenever, you bring up these two items, because it is something I've heard a lot about from local government officials. It's kind of a nice little thing to have in a handout if you have a town meeting or you're meeting with county boards, between now and the end of session.
Appreciate that. I know Representative Loeffler has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I was wondering, and perhaps Mr. Shepard could address this, I know that, for example, the Department of Human Services uses instructional bulletins to kind of direct county work in implementing state programs, and it's always been a little confusing to me as to what goes to rule and what goes in bulletin, and is that addressed in our statutes right now, or is that kind of being guided more by precedent?
Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, yes, it is addressed in statute in a couple of ways. First of all, the statute defines what is a rule, and it says that a rule is any state agency statement of general applicability and future effect that's made to implement a law. So if an instructional bulletin or a policy or a guideline or anything else really is being used to implement the law, then it is a rule, and it can only be adopted through the rulemaking process unless the department has a specific exemption, which some of them do, and I don't know about human services. The other provision, the way that law addresses this, is that there's a new process in law in which a party who believes an agency is engaged in so-called unadopted rulemaking can file a petition through the Office of Administrative Hearings and have basically have that policy statement, instructional bulletin, et cetera, declared not effective until it goes through rulemaking.
Thank you. I know Representative Khan. Okay. Anybody else? So, members, I guess I have the question of, you know, this is fairly new, but from 2001, about how the committee chair and lead on the committee is notified about information. What's the will of the committee as far as hearing about any of these issues or wanting more information? Why don't you give me some feedback on what you'd like to see, or do we need more, you know, additional oversight as far as, you know, letting you know each time we hear from some group, or I don't know if there's maybe a subgroup of this committee that would like to delve into this further during the session. Let's get some feedback on that. Rulemaking in general, and when we hear from the agencies about issues where they think they have obsolete, unnecessary, duplicative rules and want to expedite their process then for taking care of those. Representative Connie, you have any insights on that?
I we worked on that a long time when I first became chair of government operations. And I still think that there are changes that could, but I didn't get, at that time we went into the roadblocks of not, of people not wanting to change things, so I'm not willing to take it on again. Someone younger and less experienced can do it.
Any other comments or insights on that? I guess I just wanted to make sure and bring it to the attention of the committee that that is one of the areas that falls under our responsibilities here, and certainly if you can have kind of a you know, heightened awareness of anything that you see that comes through your office, and as I see things that I feel we need to spend some time on, or Representative Cotta, it sounds like you're getting a lot of the same mailings that I'm getting, you know, certainly things that need to be seen by the committee with additional time will make that judgment. So, anything further we need to know about that, Representative Khan? Okay. Representative Seifert, do you have any words of wisdom on rulemaking?
Not really, Madam Chair. Mark, if I tell you that between myself and Greiling, probably two-thirds of Chapter 14 that came out of one of us, and it's a lot of it has just been work in progress, and I think we've made a lot of good improvements to it. So if people have a problem with it, Mark's very much an expert on if you have an agency that's doing some kind of rules. And the governor can line item veto and veto rule proposals, so if there's anything that's a real stinky rule, you can contact the governor's office and let him know about it. And although it's never formally been used, Governor Ventura used the threat of veto three times, and one of them was on the gambling control board that was really getting onerous of veterans clubs, and Ventura said either withdraw it or I'm vetoing the whole thing, and so they reworked the rule. So it is a tool, although maybe not exercised formally, that he can threaten to use to kind of get the agencies in line, or the board. In some case, he doesn't have control over boards, but they have rulemaking authority.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Khan.
Oh, the one question I did have was that, and maybe this was said and I just missed it, was anything, has this Seifert law with the 25,000, has anyone used that at all?
Madam Chair, I don't believe so. The threshold's rather high, and it just took place, was it been August 1st, Mark? So it's relatively new, but we don't know of any situation yet where it's been used. I don't expect that it probably wouldn't be used a whole lot.
Anything further, rulemaking? Good discussion. Good to keep in mind here. Well, we're coming to the end of the meeting. Just want to make sure you get your blue sheet filled out. And then I know most of you have probably gotten emails with the upcoming conference. I know there's still space available. We have about, I think, at least half of the legislature coming. And so if you would like more information about that, please talk to Representative Loeffler or myself. We were both on the planning committee. And a lot of the ideas that you heard earlier today will kind of be taken to the next step there, and I encourage you to personally take on some of those issues so that we can get them moving through the legislature this session. You must not know about the conference, Representative Haas. We'll make sure you hear about it here in the next few minutes. Anything further for today? Okay, we're scheduled in, here in the basement hearing room next Thursday, February 16th at 9 a.m. So with that, meeting adjourned. Thank you, members.